competitor was any better than Wallace, so to speak, because I didn't know the man very well. But I voted for him on the basis that he could hardly have been any worse than Wallace was in the past. And I think with the Civil Rights Acts in operation to some extent, that he would not be permitted to do some of the things that Wallace was able to do. Wallace and some of his fellow state officials at that time, Patterson was probably just about as bad as Wallace. He was the one who gave us the most trouble here in Macon County.
Taking out, if you can, taking out the matter of race, has Wallace been good for the state? We hear he's a populist and he's very interested in the little people and all that sort of thing. Can we evaluate him as a governor that way?
We have to judge him, I suppose, on the basis of the environment, the social climate in which he worked. I don't know whether he's any better than some other person would have been had he been in. I don't know. Here again is a situation which is the result of previous rigid racial segregation. Now, I don't know enough about the state situations, the economic condition of the state, the political position of the state, statewide, to be able to make a good judgment there. And so it's very difficult for me, or for most Negroes, to judge state political officials on the basis of anything other than race. One of the reasons is that up until a few years ago, we had to spend so much time trying to overcome or compensate for the restrictions which were placed upon us that we didn't have any time left, or money, to any appreciable extent left, to be concerned about non-racial things. Take myself as a person who was trying to teach school, teach youngsters in school. Now, I couldn't go to graduate school in Alabama. What did I have to do? Save my money, pay railroad fare, get a graduate education outside of the state. I was not permitted to register and vote with the same degree of ease as the whites were. So I spent time and money. I made less than a white teacher in my comparable position. I had to spend more to register and vote. I had to spend more to get an education. Going to professional meetings, I couldn't go to them here in Alabama. The American Sociological Society didn't meet in the South. And so I had to spend more money than most of the whites to go outside to attend these educational meetings. In many instances, I did not have access to the same health facilities. So in order to get comparable health service, I had to spend more money. See? And so we had to spend so much time and effort and money that I can understand why Negro teachers now, public school teachers, who have been assigned to teach in white schools, are being criticized because some of them do not measure up to the same standards that the whites do. They have met the same obstacles. And that's why I'm very much concerned about compensatory health services and educational services. Now, I've said that I'm not in favor of appointing persons who are not qualified to fill certain positions simply because they're Negroes, or simply to meet a certain racial quota. But I am in favor of providing them the opportunity to become. You've heard the story about the little Negro boy at the railway station, haven't you?
Which one is that?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, well, if you heard it.
No, I said, which
one? I haven't heard.
Oh, well, the story goes that a little white boy and a little Negro boy standing at the railway station when the train rolled in, and the little white boy asked the Negro boy, don't you wish you were white so you could drive a locomotive like that? And the little black boy said, no, I don't. All I wish is that I had a chance and I'll drive it as black as I is. Well, I think in most instances this would be the case with Negro. Give them the opportunity and they can function at about the same rate as whites. We have evidence of that in some of the arts and athletics and some other areas in which there's been less restriction. Given the opportunity, they can perform as well.
How do you think Booker T. Washington would react if he were alive today? Johnny Ford's endorsement of Richard Nixon and endorsement of George Wallace on the ground that this is really a practical way of getting improvements for people in Macon County and Tuskegee. That by that, those endorsements he can get programs funded, industry brought in, jobs, at least this is an argument. This is being practical.
I'm not sure that the situation, let's say political, social situation existing at the time that Johnny Ford endorsed Nixon and Wallace, my opinion is that if Booker Washington, he would have defined the situation as such that it was unnecessary to issue a public endorsement like that at this time. Now, in 1881, 1895, I think the situation was such that such an endorsement as, or such a statement as that made by Booker T. Washington was a good statement. I don't believe W.E.B. Du Bois, with his political philosophy, could have done in Alabama what Booker T. Washington was able to do for Negroes at the level at which he worked with Negroes. And I think the Negroes who came through Tuskegee Institute during the Booker T. Washington regime have demonstrated that the kind of education that they were able to get enabled them to function effectively in the kind of society in which they live. And some of the persons who came through Tuskegee Institute during the Booker T. Washington regime have been in the forefront of the so-called civil rights movement, political efforts, some of them outside of the South. But in a different environment, they function in a different manner. Those who stayed in the South function as they were able to function under the circumstances. I think my mother's a good example. As I look back, my first consciousness of differences between whites and Negroes came when I was about 7 years old. One day in July or August, I went to a white neighbor's house, and the woman of the house offered me a piece of watermelon out of which the heart had been eaten. I'd been to school 1 year, 3 months. I had been taught during that first year in what was called a health class that it was unsanitary to eat after white folk or eat after anybody. And so I refused. 7 years old, I refused a piece of watermelon. And the white woman became very angry. And she said, I don't know what's come over these young niggas now. They think they're as good as white folk. Well, that surprised me. And I ran home and told my mother. And mother said to me, son, sit down. And I sat, and she told me, in essence, that in the little town in which I live, and in such towns like that, if Negroes wanted to remain there and live, make a living, then it was never the intelligent thing to do to refuse anything that whites offer. If they offer it to you, take it. If you don't want it, take it, get outside of their sight, throw it away. But you don't refuse if you want to stay, live and work here, because that isn't done here. Well, I think that what Booker T. Washington was saying to students who were here, that if you want to get along in advance here, there's certain things you have to do, certain compromises you have to make. Now, when I came here, I had been, it had been drilled into me by my mother to try to save as much as you can out of what you earn, so that as soon as possible you can become as independent as possible. So when I came here my first year, I was coming out of the store with an armful of groceries one day, and I met someone, a colleague. He asked me, what did I have? I told him I had some groceries. He said, man, you're not supposed to carry any groceries home. You're supposed to let them be delivered to your house by the delivery boy. You're supposed to run a charge account. Well, I became known as Cash and Carry Committee my first year here. And when the boycott came later, I didn't have to worry about my credit being cut off, because I didn't have any credit. I operated on a cash and carry basis. So my credit wasn't cut off. I could say what I wanted to say because I didn't owe anybody. And so Booker T. Washington, I think, was telling these people to work hard, earn a living, save what you can, live as cleanly as you can, because cleanliness is one of the things that he taught. And I think it was kind of education which was needed at that time in this particular year. I don't think that Booker T. Washington would have felt that the situation at the present time demanded or even strongly suggested that such a thing as Ford did was necessary. Now, no, at this time, under the circumstances, now, I think Booker T. Washington would have been shrewd enough to get as much support as he could without making this kind of endorsement. One man's thought.
In your position is that Booker T. Washington was in today's conditions, I don't have to go around insulting the president or come out against him or Wallace, but that the laws have changed and conditions have changed, and these programs are outdue,
yeah,
because we're citizens.
Yeah.
And if we design the programs well, we're entitled to some money and can get them without being a...
No, as Ford said, if I understood it correctly, he had a perfect right to endorse who he wants to. We certainly get that right. I just said that I think if I were in his position, I simply couldn't have done it. But if that's his position, I'll not make any public statement against him because of his endorsement. I haven't made one.
As you look back, is there anything you would have done differently?
Personally, and with the Tuskegee Civic Association? No, I don't. I think that in my non-academic work in Tuskegee and Macon County, that most of it has been based upon a principle which we who have studied in the field of sociology have accepted as a very basic principle, and that is the definition of the situation. that what we do, if we want to do it as intelligently and as effectively as possible, is to do it as a result of our definition of the situation in which we live and work. And the situation changes from time to time. And that that this is probably the best basis for formulating a program of social action. And some 10 or 12 years ago, I formulated a list of questions which some persons had been asking me to formulate as a basis for a program of social action. If a group is planning to go into social action, how should they proceed? And my reply was that they first answer the series of questions. And just a few of the questions. One question, what is considered the ideal situation which the group wants? What is the situation now? What is the difference, the nature of the difference and the degree of difference between what is wanted and what is? Some of the others, does a group really want to move from what is to what is desired? Is a group willing to pay for it? What will it cost in time, money, and effort? What resources are available for use in moving from where we are to where we want to be? And so on. Now, if these questions are answered, we get then what I call, what others call, a definition of the situation. And as I look back, as you mentioned, would I have done anything different? I don't think of anything that I would have done differently. The house in which we sit now was built by a contractor who vouched for me to become a registered voter. He discovered that I wanted a house built at that time. He said he wanted to build it. I said to him, I want to become a registered voter. He said, you're not a registered voter? I said, no. So why aren't you? He said, well, I haven't been able to get a second white person to vouch for me. At that time, only whites could vouch for Negro applicants. And he said, well, no problem there. I said, I'll vouch for it. And so I fill out the application. I've been able to get the first person to agree to his name, but the second person would have to go to the courthouse and sign his name in the presence of the registrar. And that I had not been able to get. So he went with me over to the courthouse, signed the application form, and he said, now I'm ready to get the contract. I said to him, I haven't received my certificate of registration yet. He said, that's no problem, you can get it in a few days. So 3 days later, I got the certificate of registration. So I called him and said, I'm ready to give you the contract.
What year was that?
1939.
As you think back over all those years you worked on voter registration, the apportionment case and so on, how you look at two black legislators, mayor, council, city commission in this county, do you give any sense of gratification?
Not much. Because this is what some of us anticipate. And we think it's just a natural result of a process on the part of persons becoming active participants in the political process, performing their duty. Now, the thing which several of us are hoping is that those Negroes who've been fortunate enough to get into the positions of political influence, political power, political opportunity, and some of us prefer to think of it as political opportunity and political power. One of the things that I have not been enthusiastic about is the concept of black power that's been bandied around. I don't think there's anything wrong with the concept, except that for some persons, it conveys the idea of being in a position to exercise domination over persons, and this has never appealed to me. Our hope, when I'm speaking of persons like Mitchell, W.E. Mitchell, Beasley, James A. Johnson, and so on, who worked very closely with me, or with whom I worked very closely, what we hope for is that those persons who've gotten into office, that they would recognize that they have certain obligations to the society, to work as diligently as they can to perform the best possible services, and that this requires a considerable amount of sacrifice on the part of themselves and on the part of their wives. Now, fortunately, I had a good wife, who made the home life such that I never did have to leave home in a hurry, and I was never hesitant about coming back. And I think what little I was able to do was done to a considerable extent because of the nature of the environment in the home. And I think that was true of James A. Johnson and two or three other persons here. I've been on some select committees for screening candidates for certain positions, presidents, and two presidents of college and so on. And one of the questions I ask is, what kind of wife does he have? And some persons have been, names have been scratched, not because of themselves, but because of their wives. Because what a person is able to do in certain positions, in certain circumstances, will depend to a considerable extent on what kind of family life there is. And I've known some persons in positions, and particularly in the educational area, who have not been able to function effectively, mainly because of the nature of their wives. Mm-hmm. Guild by association? That's not fair, is it?
The question more is, will wives soon be judged by their husbands when they're being screened for jobs?
Is there anything else we haven't covered that you want to
ask? I want to ask one more question. That is, what effect do you think it's going to have in Alabama, the change, reapportionment, if suddenly you go from 3 black legislators to 15?
I don't think it's going to be any very significant change, because with 15 going in the first, in the next 4 years, there might be some effort made on the part of Negro legislators to remember that they are Negro legislators. So Negroes elected to the legislature. They're going to be in a difficult position because some Negro voters who voted for them are going to expect them to do the impossible. But 4 years from now, 8 years from now, let's say, most Negro voters, most Negroes who are in the state legislature are going to be legislators. Most of them. And they're going to think and behave in much the same manner as whites think and behave. Now, I think this is based on the conception that given the opportunities, relatively equal opportunity to participate as free men, as human beings, as legislators, rather than Negro legislators, they're going to believe as most of the whites believe, act as most of them act. And I think this is going to be true. Where schools become actually desegregated and integrated, the whites and Negroes are going to behave like human beings, good or bad. And much of what we do, many of us do, as Negroes, is done because we have been identified as Negroes and treated as Negroes rather than as human beings. Now, see, as soon as the situation becomes such that Negroes are treated as human beings, then they're going to begin to behave as human beings, with the good qualities, the bad qualities. And you might have gotten the impression there that I am a strong supporter of the idea that the nature of the environment, the social climate, exerts a tremendous influence upon the individual participating in that crime.
End interview with Charles G. Gomillion. No more transcription. This tape. C.G. Gomillion. No more transcription, this tape.